We're doing Binyan HaBayit. We were in the middle of the questionnaire. We had asked the first 10 questions. Number one, what are the three most important things in marriage? Number two, who are your role models? Number three, what is it fair for your wife to expect from you in marriage? Number four, what is it fair for you to expect from your wife? Number five, what do you expect to get out of marriage? Number six, what do you anticipate will be your greatest weakness going into marriage? Will it change in the course of married life? Number seven, how rough should couples fight? Number eight, do you anticipate this will be a problem? Number nine, what if she smacks you? Number 10, how many children do you want to have? And we're up to number 11. Number 11, okay, you say we did. Who comes first, the spouse or the kids? Okay, so number... Okay, we shall see. Number 12. What day would you want to spend together with your family? What day would you want to spend together with your family? To spend together with your family. And question number 13 is, what night? What night? Question number 14. What would you want to do during family time? Question number 11. Who comes first, the spouse or the kids, is where we left off. Question number 12. What day would you want to spend together with your family? Question number 13. What night? Question number 14. What would you want to do during family time? Question number 15. Would you want to learn Torah with your children? Question number 16, are you equipped to do that? Question number 17, what is a father's responsibilities? What are a father's responsibilities towards his children? What are a father's responsibilities towards his children? So we said in 17, what are a father's responsibilities towards his children? Now number 18, what are a mother's responsibilities towards children? What are a mother's responsibilities towards children? Before I read question number 19, I want to make a request. Please, no comments. Don't point anything out or don't ask any questions. Just write whatever answer makes sense to you, but don't say anything. Question number 19. What are a husband's responsibilities to the family? What are a husband's responsibilities to the family? Question number 20. What are a wife's responsibilities to the family? What are a wife's responsibilities to the family? Questions number 19 and 20 were, what are a husband's responsibilities to the family? And what are a wife's responsibilities to the family? Now, if you still have the page in front of you from last week, compare what you wrote with what you wrote for question number 3 and 4. Question number 3 was, what is it fair for your wife to expect from you in marriage? And question number 4 is, what is it fair for you to expect from your wife? Now compare that with what you wrote, are a mother's responsibilities and a husband's responsibilities, as in 17, 18, 19, and 20. Meaning 17 and 18 focused on a father's and mother's responsibilities to children, and 19 and 20 focused on husband and wife responsibility to the family. Whereas question 3 and 4 purposely focused on what is it fair from your wife to expect from you and for you to expect from your wife. I purposely set it up this way because I think that many people, when they're dating, focus on what can I expect from her vis-a-vis me, what can she expect from me vis-a-vis her. And people forget when they're dating that there's a question of children and there's a question of family. And you'll notice that your answers to question 3 and 4 are going to be distinctly different than your answers to question 17, 18, 19, 20. Whereas in truth, you have to ask yourself if that was correct. Ask yourself. I'm not marking this. I don't even want to see it, unless you want me to. But I want you to think what it means if on question 3 and 4, when you were asked, what is it fair from your wife to expect from you in marriage? And what is it fair from you to expect from your wife? So you could say it was a little misleading because I worded it in marriage. But you know what? Marriage involves family and marriage involves children. And all too often when people date, their focus is on what they think is marriage, which is just me and her and her and me. So I purposely, in the very beginning, asked you that question. And only now, 15 questions later, I'm asked you, what are a father's responsibility or a mother's responsibility to children, and what are a husband and wife's responsibility to the family?
And what was 3 and 4?
3 and 4 were, what is it fair for your wife to expect from you in marriage, and what is it fair from you to expect from your wife? So do me a favor, take a minute and read what you wrote and compare. And this is one of the things I want you guys to think about. When we're approaching dating, very often I told people when I was dating that one of the things that's first on my list is a good mother for my kids and a good partner in raising the kids, and that we should have equal perspectives on how to raise the kids and priorities. And very often I find with today's generation that the kids and the family and all that doesn't even come up in the dating. And then people show up to marriage, and they show up being married, and a year or two into marriage they suddenly discover that, wait a second, we're not on the same page. She wants a TV in the house, I don't. She wants to send to co-ed education, I don't. He wants the kids to be watching TV and going out to movies with girlfriends, and I don't. Meaning it goes, I encounter this all the time. And I feel like part of the reason is because there's a huge misconception in our generation. People are very, very focused on the me and her and she and me. And people have very little focus on she and the kids, me and the kids, us and the kids, us as parents, us and a family. And that's why I wanted you guys to see how your own responses compare. So now you guys have the pages in front of you. Take a minute to read and compare what you yourself wrote. Question number 21. What are the most important things you want to give your children? Please list at least 5. What are the most important things you want to give your children? Please list at least 5. For sure. It's very important. The answer to these questions, I think, should really be something that, if not all of them, but many of them, you've thought about. And my goal is when you approach these questions, even though you all seem to have answers right away, I see you're writing like a second after I finish the question, you're writing answers. But my goal is that you stop and think, how thought out are these answers? And maybe I should invest more time. And that's where we're headed with the questions in a minute, to help focus. What do we want to get out of these questions? And with that, we'll move on to question number 22. Are we ready? Danny, yeah?
Yeah.
Question number 22. What is God's role in the marriage? The Creator, the Omnipotent, the Omnipresent, Elohim, what is his role in a marriage? His with a capital H. Question number 23. Please don't ask questions. I'm saying as much as I want to say and not more than that. And you can feel free to answer what you want. And after you answer what you want, please reflect on your answer. Question number 23. Just look at what you wrote. Question number 23. Who are you? Question number 23 was, who are you? And question number 24 is, who will you be after marriage? Now after you've been married a while, who do you anticipate you will be? You could say when you'll be 75 and married for 50 years. How do you anticipate you will evolve? Where will you be after marriage? After marriage meaning by the time you die or whatever. You guys get the picture. Question number 25. When you started answering these questions, did you think about your children? Question number 25. When you started answering these questions, did you think about your children? Question number 26. Are you ready to date? And obviously there's a connection. Achen, so kvar ve'arnu ha'inyan haze dehakavana lemidato ha'miyuchedet shel Moshe Rabbeinu. We've already explained that the intent over here is not Moshe specifically, but rather Moshe's specific trait, ha'anava, the modesty, ve'hashiflut, banit yached mikol adam. Moshe was singular in the fact that he was lowly, he was modest. Like the verse says, the man Moshe, he was more modest than all men on the face of the earth. That is the greatness of Moshe, our teacher. Like the Torah says, why were you not fearful for speaking about my servant Moshe? And our sages said, you should have been scared from talking badly about him if he were just Moshe afal pishe no avdi. Even if he wouldn't have been my servant, such a great man, such a modest person, how did you allow yourself to speak badly about him? Even had he not been my servant, the avdi, and just the fact that he's my servant afal pishe no Moshe, even though he wasn't Moshe. And from here we see that Moshe had two great levels. The name Moshe in and of itself is the representation of Moshe's modesty. Moshe's essence was his modesty. Then there was the aspect that he was God's servant. So that's what the Netivot Shalom says. When we say Moshe had to redeem the Jewish people, it means that aspect of Moshe, that modesty. And that was the strength that took us out of Egypt, al yedei midato shel Moshe Rabbeinu, through that trait of Moshe Rabbeinu, asher chidesh derech geula miyuchedet mimina mitoch shiflut v'hitbatlut. Moshe taught a new way of redemption. A redemption that stems from a person's being low, from a person's being modest. Yesh geula kasher Yisrael ruim legeula. There is a redemption when we deserve it. Sheyesh biyadam mitzvot v'zchuyot gdolot, that the Jews have mitzvot and great merits. They're doing what they're supposed to. Ach kasher Yisrael meshukaim b'memtet sharei tumah. But when the Jewish people are sunk, 49 gates of defilement, then be adam zchuyot u'masim tovim, and they do not have in their hands merits and good deeds, enem nigalim ela bekoach midato shel Moshe, they cannot be redeemed, but with the strength of Moshe's trait, shibtelut gmura l'Hashem itbarach. That is where a person says, Hashem, I completely make myself secondary, I completely make myself batel. A good translation for batel. Person makes himself negligible next to Hashem. There, okay.
Nullifies himself.
Okay. Ke'ain ve'efes. That a person says, I am like nothing next to my Creator. V'zeu shamar kadosh baruch hu l'moshe imen ata goel. And that's what God said to Moshe, if you don't redeem them, they won't be redeemed. Shebli abchina shelcha habtelut ke'ain ve'efes en derech geula. Without that aspect, your strength, your ability to say, I am nothing but my connection to Hashem. I on my own, what am I? There's no way to be redeemed without that. Without that possibility of modesty, that strength of modesty. And about this it says, Leman tizkot yom tzedcha me'eretz Mitzrayim kol yimei chayecha, so that you remember you're leaving from Egypt throughout the days of your life. Shakoch liyitziat Mitzrayim hu b'midato shel Moshe. That the strength to leave Egypt is with Moshe's trait, mikoch sheyudi batel umvutal Hashem yitbarach. With this aspect that a Jew makes himself null and void next to his Creator. Uvechol miatzav sheyudi nimtza. And in whatever state a Jew finds himself, afilu b'matzav agaruah biyoter, even in the worst state, shum shukav memtet sharei tumah, that he's completely sunk in the 49 gates of defilement, mikoach hashiflut v'abtelut, from that strength of modesty, of nullifying oneself, sheyodeh sheino klum v'ayin v'epes muchlat, when he recognizes that how minuscule and how nothing he is next to his Creator, nigal v'yotze mimitzayim, he could be redeemed and leave Egypt. Now, you guys will forgive me, but I have no clue what he's talking about. I'm reading and translating, but I still don't understand what I'm reading. Ve'ita b'shem ha'Baal Shem Tov zchuto yagen aleinu. I'm hoping it'll get clearer as we go along. And we have from the name of the Baal Shem Tov. Ala katub ki tetzel l'milchama aloi v'echa v'rit asus v'recha v'am rav mimcha lo tira mehem. When you go out to war on your enemy and you see a horse and chariots, a great nation, don't be scared. For Hashem your God is with you, who took you out of Egypt. So the Baal Shem Tov said, this is a reference to the war against one's desire. You see a nation that's stronger than you. It seems like it's beyond one's strength. The Yetzer Hara seems to be overpowering. Don't be scared of them, for Hashem your God is with you, who took you out of the land of Egypt. כמו שבעת אשר עמד הקדוש ברוך הוא להוציא את ישראל ממצרים היו ישראל משוקעים אז ממתת שרי תומה. Just like when the time came for God to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, they were sunk 49 gates into defilement. ולא הייתה אפשרות להוציאה משם. It seemed impossible to take them out of Egypt. אלא שחטא הקדוש ברוך הוא מחתרת מתחת לכיסא הכבוד. But God, so to speak, dug under his heavenly throne. כעניין שנאמר במנשה, שחטא לו הקדוש ברוך הוא מחתרת. Just like it says about the wicked king Menashe, that when he repented, really he shouldn't have had a right to do tshuva, but God dug a way for him to do tshuva. כך חטא אז הקדוש ברוך הוא מחתרת מתחת לכיסא הכבוד עבור כל ישראל. So too God dug under his heavenly throne for all of the Jewish people. ומכאן חיזוק לכל יהודי באשר הוא. And from here, every Jew has to be strengthened. גם אם אין לו שום דרך אין הקדוש ברוך הוא, איך שהקדוש ברוך הוא יגאל אותו. Even if there's no path for God to redeem him, ידע שביציאת מצרים פתח קדוש ברוך הוא פתח לכל הדורות. That when we left Egypt, God made an opening for all generations, ופתח לכל יחיד על ידי שחטא ומחתרת מתחת לכיסא הכבוד. When God dug a tunnel, so to speak, under his throne, God said, I'm making an entrance, everyone can make it back. Even if you'd look at it logically and you'd say, after what I've done, there's no way I'm getting back. God says, yeah, the standard paths, there's no way you're getting back. But I make unusual paths for you to come back, and you're always welcome back, and you'll make it back. So when you go out to war, when the Pasuk says you go out to war, and the enemy seems to be overbearing, and the enemy seems to be much stronger, don't be scared, because the God who took you out of Mitzrayim is with you. It's Hashem. What Hashem is saying, said the Baal Shem Tov, is that when I took you out of Mitzrayim, you see, I did it against all odds. Not only against all physical odds, but also against all spiritual odds. By the same token, any time you feel overwhelmed by the spiritual world that you seem to be fighting a losing battle, don't worry. Just like I took you out of Mitzrayim, there's room for everyone to come back. If not in the method that you think, then in an unusual method. Like God says, I dig a hole through my throne to let you back in. Now, I'm not sure what he means. That's what I said earlier. I'm not sure what he means that the way to fight this battle, the way out of Mitzrayim and the way to overcome the material world is through modesty. I think, and here this is my own understanding, I don't know if it's true, that part of our connection to the material world, part of what brings us down, if we'd really think about it, then we wouldn't be attracted. Think about it for a second. Any physical thing, what about it attracts us? If it were our logic, if we were really, really, really logical beings, then we wouldn't be attracted to almost anything physical. Yes, you need to eat, you need to drink, you need to have a roof over your head. There are certain basic needs every person has. But the things that pull us down in this material world is the excess that we desire, and even the things that we need, the manner in which we go about obtaining them and the manner in which we utilize them. Now, why is it that we want a fancy house? Do we really need 50 bedrooms for our family? Do we really need the best car in order to get to work? Do we really need all the things we think about when we contend with this material world? What we're doing is we're trying to boost our ego, to satiate our soul, to satiate our hunger, our everlasting desire for self-fulfillment, for feelings of self-worth, with a world that's passing. When we try to do it with a material world, what we're doing is we're taking something spiritual that's within us, and we're trying to feed it something physical. And this lie, this falsehood, is at the root of the discontentment that's been plaguing the world almost since creation. And all the more so in our generation, where the material wealth has reached proportions that people thought would only be in an imaginary world. I mean, what we have today, if you tell someone 100 years ago that in your house you could just turn a faucet and have running water, push a button and have a light, push a button and you have a screen, you see what's going on all over the world on a computer, every person today, you want to talk to your parents for free, you go on Skype, you see them in 1 second, I mean, people would say that's Gan Eden. Now we have it, and we're very discontented, because we're never going to have satiation from the material. The material is a lie, the material is a tool. But when we think we can get satisfaction from that tool and make that the essence of life, then we are lying to ourselves. So a person is going to invest a lot of money to go on that vacation to the Caribbean, but when he comes back, he'll feel empty. A person is going to spend a lot of money to get the biggest screen TV or the fanciest car, he'll go into debt, and then he'll start driving it. And after a week, he'll see his neighbor with a newer version. Or after a year, suddenly his is outdated and he hasn't paid it off yet. And he looks at himself and he says, wait a second. Am I worth something? And at that point, he has to ask himself, is my worth from the car? Or is my worth from something else? Now, if my worth is from the car, then I better get a new car. I have to be ahead of the crowd. But if my worth is from something else, then I didn't really need to spend that money on the car. So it's cyclical. And the question is, do we break out of the cycle? When a person lives a world that's completely material, and that's what he's saying, that the material is a representation of Mitzrayim in our lives. So how do we escape that? When we connect to the truth. Connecting to the truth is the concept of modesty. Really, haughtiness, this inflation of ego, is lying to ourselves. When a person stops and says, what am I really worth? Let's take a step back. Why don't we stop and say, what am I really worth? Because we're scared of the answer. So I'd much rather say, I'm worth the Jaguar. I bought the Jaguar. I'm worth the Infiniti. I'm worth the Rolex watch. I'm worth all these external things, because then I could lie to myself. I am worth. But if we stop and we deflate it and we say, okay, what am I really worth? So then that's where modesty comes in. Now, truly modest person, so he is being truthful with himself. And when we work with truth, then we're working on the path to true happiness. And what we're doing is we're taking a route which is painful, it's not easy, but a route which will ultimately lead us to a balanced life, a life where we'll be able to have a certain amount of material goods and utilize them correctly, but they won't be the focus. They'll be the tool. So he says, when a person is overwhelmed and he says to himself, I'm in this material world. What do you mean? I have a job. I have to work 7 in the morning to 9 at night. I just get home in time to eat something, get to sleep, and get up the next morning to get back to work. How am I ever going to get out of this? So he says the first step is getting that trait of Moshe Rabbeinu. That trait where a person says, wait a second, really I'm not everything I'm hyped up to be. A person is truthful with himself. That's the Hitpatlut LaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the first step in gaining true worth. When we recognize that our worth is not these material externals, that's not the happiness or the value of a person in this world. That's the first step. And as we evolve, step after step, so then we could grow again. But if we want to get out of what he's calling the Mitzrayim of our lives, so then we have to begin by deflating the bubble. And deflating is a term I'm using purposely because we're headed towards Pesach. And on Pesach we eat deflated bread, we eat matzah. And the idea of matzah is humility. That's the concept of matzah. Bread is all puffed up. Matzah doesn't have all the hot air. It's just water and flour. But that's the bread of faith. That's the bread that took us out of Mitzrayim. That's this concept that we're discussing. Leaving Mitzrayim every day. Remembering our exodus from Mitzrayim day and night. So that's my humble understanding of what he's saying. I'm not sure it's right, but maybe it's right.